I ended episode 2, part 4, by stating that leasehold abuse is not a symptom of the private sector alone. In fact, the problem starts in the public sector, in my view, and that's because there's zero requirement for full transparency in that sector at all. The episode concluded that there was then perhaps some merit in local councils being forced to go bust, because only then might those who govern the framework really understand and learn the hard way what it is to tread carefully, act diligently, and with respect and consideration concerning taxpayers' funds. But instead of that, what we currently see is very little or no strategic sourcing, very little or no truly independent tendering process, which, to be clear, is incredibly easy to manipulate, fix, rig, however you want to put it. And I'll provide some explicit examples of what I've come across personally soon enough. But the process can be fixed to ensure there is little or no questioning and interrogation as to A, who's getting the contracts, and B, the actual expenditure and the reasonableness of that. Throughout my life, and certainly with what I've witnessed over the last few decades, and obviously after speaking to many people, both those I know personally and those I've come across in day-to-day life, is that people are sick of paying taxes through the nose to government, only to watch their taxes being urinated up the wall. Well, it's no surprise then that people feel exactly the same about how their service charge contributions are being used, or I underline here, misused. Again, let's not forget, these freeholders have their fingers in many pies, all claiming their slice of that pie however they can, from servicing local council needs, as I've previously stated, to the servicing of management requirements and needs in the social sector arena. More specifically, the social sector housing arena. And I wanted to reference at this point a particular case that surfaced in the press early last year. I was first alerted to this by a news article, but then by a follow-up interview with this particular gentleman on ITV's This Morning show. I was especially interested in this man's campaign last year, not primarily because of anti-litter, but because councils in general are essentially urinating our funds up the wall with gravy train contracts, mates rates contracts, and deals across the board, whereby in some cases contracts are not only awarded to those who do not deserve it, but also simply not being fulfilled whatsoever by those contractors or suppliers. In the scenario highlighted by Danny Lucas, it's clearly by design. I'd urge you to listen to the interviews, especially at 3 minutes in, where he gets to the crux of what I'm talking about here, but it's worthwhile listening to the entire interview. He'd commented in the interview with Holly and Phil that he'd proven, through multiple Freedom of Information Act requests and other evidence that he'd gathered, that essentially, and I quote, contractors were being paid without penalty to allow this to happen, which is shocking. All of the links to the interview and the respective articles are in the podcast notes. But just register that thought for a moment and log it somewhere in your mental filing cabinet. Because the next time someone says to you that this is all conspiracy theory and that there is no evidence to support such quote unquote baseless and unsubstantiated theories, well, of course there is. And you can prove it until the cows come home. Of course, cast your mind back to episode 2, part 3, referencing the code break sting of 2020. There are several key sentences within that article that clearly prove what I'm talking about. But essentially, the article reveals that almost 750 people were arrested, all from different backgrounds. The first of several interesting comments made by The Independent, showing that crime is not delineated by stature, status, or level of respectability, is: they appear to be successful, respectable business people, but they are dangerous individuals. The second comment is, the operation has also revealed the identities of an unknown number of corrupt police officers and employees in different law enforcement agencies. A third comment of interest is, and one I'd ask you to remember for when I come on to talk about Rudy Giuliani and how he brought to justice the key mafia in the USA, for offences which included extortion, labour and construction related and other types of racketeering in a bid to clean up New York in the 1980s and through to the 90s. The platform was infiltrated by agencies in France and the Netherlands and shared via Europol to partners including the UK. So those are three key sentences highlighted in the Independent article about the 2020 codebreak sting, featured in episode 2, part 3. The reason this story struck a huge chord with me is because I see exactly the same thing happening within leasehold. That is, financial abuse through direct theft of finances, or inflated pricing through the adoption of tactics such as supplier rigging, fixing, control and kickbacks, all in the pursuit of huge margins, and worse, whether the job is done or not. This is especially true, more specifically in respect of the contracts they're paying out on for big fat zero service. I think what's been observed over the years is that councils are utilising our money for self-serving purposes, perhaps colluding with those who can line their pockets, because let's face it, government salaries aren't the biggest in the world, are they? Having said that, some senior council bosses are on six-figure sums. The simple fact is, it may be the case, well, in their minds anyway, that even if they were paid handsomely, it's never quite enough. I always think back to the prison warden in The Shawshank Redemption in this regard, because enough is never quite enough for these types of characters. Indeed, albeit fictional, one of the key themes of that movie was that he was a key senior member of the church, wasn't he? Not only that, but he had his fingers in pies with local councillors, and he was outwardly respected by the heads of other key institutions. Ah, the genius that was that Stephen King novel. In fact, in the particular leasehold I'd previously mentioned, back in 2013, and therein actually, I labelled it Shawshank. It was a sort of natural reaction to what I'd been observing for over a 2 to 3 year period to that point. The bottom line is, it's in the freeholders and their management company's best interests to secure kickbacks from those purportedly provisioning the services in order to cream as much profit as possible. However, in order to do that, they have to fix the process of securing the contracts with their preferred suppliers in the first place. And whilst you might think it's not, it is in fact exceptionally easy to do, certainly where Section 20s are concerned anyway. I want to go a bit further and point out here, on the matter of the Danny Lucas case, that Mr. Lucas said in one news report, following what appeared to be deliberate sabotage attempts at his efforts to clean up his town, according to one news report. On this point, Danny states, "It seems a great coincidence that the council get highlighted by the national press for doing nothing and me having to pay and do it myself on their behalf. And then within days, our business estate gets heavily trashed by a stranger for the first time ever in 16 years. This behaviour defiantly supports, endorses and even sustains the broken windows theory. In criminology, the broken windows theory states that visible signs of crime, antisocial behaviour and civil disorder create an urban environment that encourages further crime and disorder, including serious crimes. And of course, for all of what I've just mentioned regarding Danny's statement and the broken windows theory, I'll put links in the podcast notes. But of course, all of these behaviours do tie in with what we know to be built-in deterioration. You know, the same kind that's deliberately built into our appliances. Our washing machines, for example, designed to only last 2 to 4 years, else we'd never buy another appliance again, would we? And that's in a world where the environment and sustainability have hit an all-time low. With what Mr. Lucas calls out as sabotage, well, that was a hugely interesting point for me. Because what does all of the behaviour that Mr. Lucas talks about reek of? That's right, you've guessed it, racketeering. The term racketeering defines exactly what we know to be that of mafia-style behaviour. The Cornell Law School, Legal Information Institute, explains this phrase articulately by stating, "Racketeering is a set of illegal activities aimed at commercial profit that may be disguised as legitimate business deals. Racketeering is defined by a coordinated effort by multiple people to repeatedly earn a profit." Wikipedia articulates racketeering similarly. Racketeering is a type of organised crime in which the person sets up a coercive, fraudulent, extortionary or otherwise illegal coordinated scheme or operation, a racket, to repeatedly or consistently collect a profit. Again, I'll add the links to these articles to the podcast notes. But remember, All of these individuals have law firms acting on their behalf, and we'll always have an army of lawyers and barristers supplying that ring and wall of protection. So in reality, you're dealing with the exact same challenge within the legal justice system as you are with the rest of society, that of light and dark. To be 100% clear here, the legal justice system is no different to that of the rest of society, despite its mantra that it operates entirely objectively and independently. In fact, Aristotle stated that the law is reason free from passion. This means that the law is objective, based on logic rather than driven by desires and or emotions. But it's not purely logic that defines law. That logic is based on the supply of evidence. I always say that relationships are founded on connections. Thus, connections and relationships form the framework and fabric of society. With that in mind, to believe that nefarious connections couldn't possibly exist between those in government and landowners or business owners is quite nonsensical. I have just given you one key historic example of Danny Lucas, who has effectively challenged connections of those exact stakeholder types. But what if those types of connections seep into the legal justice system as well? There really is no difference. In fact, I would argue that the legal justice system is a mirror reflection of society, i.e., the darker society gets, the darker that the legal justice system will get, because one is influenced by the other. And let's face it, law firms are ultimately paid by their client, dark or light. Therefore, would they be likely to bite the hand that feeds? I'll come on to talk about relationships and connections when I talk about my experiences of the FTT in a coming episode. But we have seen evidence that, to be honest, is no surprise to us of these types of behaviours and traits in main government periodically, haven't we? With the more recently publicised PPE agreements and the fallout of questionable financial agreements and arrangements during the pandemic. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Remember what I said in episode 2, part 2, about the EU framework, indeed any trade agreement. The EU framework, as an example, having been described by the Right Honourable Michael Gove as an corrupt framework. And that's exactly what he'd be referring to. Again, I come back to the point surrounding the legal justice system, which is just because you can't prove something, it doesn't mean it's not happening. I emphasise that point again. Just because you cannot prove something, it does not mean that it is not happening. I mean, that's the very crux of what drives investigative journalism, isn't it? That relentless, tenacious, dog with a bone, inner gut feeling or instinct that something is up, something doesn't sit right or doesn't add up. Hence the drive to secure that evidence to support the hunch. And don't forget, I've seen all of this behaviour in leasehold abuse, where it's very easy to rig the Section 20 process. And I'll come on to discuss explicit examples of what I've experienced in detail in episode 3, parts 2 and 3. But I think in answer to the question, do councils deserve to go bust as a harsh lesson to them to stop mismanaging our funds, fixing supplier contracts or agreements in the pursuit of kickbacks and other trade agreements beneficial only to themselves, which we all know happens, provable or not, I think the unanimous response is quite simply a big fat yes. It just goes to show, privatisation or nationalisation, or deregulation or regulation, matters very little to those at the top, because almost always and invariably, it's them taking full advantage of the framework in whichever framework is adopted and is provided as their sandpit to play in. It's very easy to rig the supplier selection process, and it's very easy to misdirect funding. I say again, I too have personally experienced similar behaviours in leasehold as with Mr. Lucas and the council. Let me explain. Historically, with one particular leasehold I've owned for almost 30 years, the one I've mentioned several times before, the more financial questions I asked, the more I observed my car being keyed, the more penalties in the form of admin charges or other such penalties I secured, and the more vilification and punishment I received. All covertly carried out, of course, but invariably in cases of covert narcissistic abuse, that's how it works. And it's all dished out by those in power. In this case, the management company, the freeholders and the directors, more specifically the ex-directors of the Residents Association, and indeed the new ones, indeed, who are more or less all one and the same, and I'll explain that framework in my next episode. Heck, with what I've experienced historically, they may as well have nailed me to a cross. To be clear, I'm still in receipt of the same treatment today. Extreme covert narcissistic abuse, that is. Of course, it hasn't gone away. But these days, it's more shrouded in politeness than it was before. Yet, interestingly, they're still unable to evidence severe failings and discrepancies in the accounts. And the cons, in my view, are simply wrapped in different coloured gift wrap. Although they know now that going to court again would seriously expose them the next time round, especially since this particular freeholder has, as previously mentioned, secured themselves an injunction for extortion in the Crown Court, according to the defendant in that specific case. In the words of Charles Parton, a near 40-year UK diplomat specialising in China, Hong Kong and Taiwan, who stated in a lunchtime news interview on ITV on the 25th of March 2024 in respect of government accusing China of malicious cyber attacks, which unfortunately has been removed from the ITVX news platform and replaced with the evening news report instead. Although I do have an audio recording of this report and interview, both the link and the audio I'll pop into the podcast notes, but do listen to the audio at 2.26 minutes in. Charles says, "When you're dealing with a bully, you need to stand up and let them know that you're not gonna be bullied, and then they usually back off." Although that would not seem to be the case in my experience of leasehold ownership, because this particular freehold bully is so extremely narcissistic in my view, he just steps back and lets someone else do the job for him. Which is generally how extremely narcissistic, psychopathic, wealthy individuals invariably operate. Someone else does the dirty work. So what do you do when that bully is your government? More to follow on this in parts 2 and 3.